Well, I hope that last statement is true, but it may not be. I'm unfortunately going to be telling you about things that I don't understand mainly. The reason I won't actually follow the announced topic is that once I realized I was the first speaker, I decided I didn't want to begin the conference by dwelling into the details of the twisted cohomology of RP5, which would have been a logical consequence of taking seriously the title. So instead I decided to try to give some kind of interview, some kind of introduction to some of the excitement about anti-de Sitter space, but while putting the accents on what one doesn't understand about it. And of course, with no guarantee that I'm accenting the right ununderstood aspects. And the only realistic hope, well, maybe someone later in the week will manage to straighten out whatever confusions I'll make. I wonder if that's focused. Okay. In a theory with gravity, regardless of the nature of the theory, something which we can deduce just from low-energy physics is that a theory with gravity doesn't have gauge-invariant local operators. A usual gauge-invariant local operator, let's say phi of x, can be gauge-invariant if we've got a definite notion of x, but in a theory with diffeomorphism invariance, x, the point x, has no definite meaning. So there isn't a gauge-invariant local observable phi of x, and as far as we can understand, all observables in theories with gravity are global in some sense. For instance, if the world is asymptotically flat, one has the S matrix, which is the response to sources that create and annihilate particles in the far past and the far future, respectively. So it's a kind of global observable because you have to talk about the far past and the far future to make sense out of it, to define it. Well, the S matrix is the only completely clear-cut observable in a theory with gravity in an asymptotically flat world. If you ask what else at least there might be, people speculate about global observables such as the integral integral over all x of some scalar. You can't take a scalar like the 10th power of the Ricci scalar at a point x because you don't know what x is, but if you integrate it over all x, you might get something. Whether you do isn't clear because, for example, there might be infrared divergences. But there might be observables like this, although they're not much discussed lately, and there's no evidence for them yet, at least in string theory. So what we most know about, at any rate, if the cosmological constant is zero, is the S matrix. What if the cosmological constant is negative? Well, if the cosmological constant is negative, there's actually no notion of an S matrix. And the reason is that the basic prerequisite for having an S matrix isn't obeyed. The whole idea of the S matrix is that particles propagate in the far past or the far future to spatial infinity and stop interacting. Of course, they might form bound states, but then in turn the bound states separate from other things that they're not bound to and stop interacting. So you get a simple description of the Hilbert space as a Fox space in the far past and in the far future, and the S matrix is the transition between those two simple descriptions. So the basic prerequisite is that the interactions must turn off in the past or the future. That's what isn't true in anti-de Sitter space. In anti-de Sitter space, the interactions never turn off. The Penrose diagram of anti-de Sitter space looks something like this. Time runs vertically, and what's a little unusual about it is that in a certain conformal sense, spatial infinity is only at a finite distance. So the Penrose diagram has these boundaries which conformally are at a finite distance, although from other metrically, in some senses, they're at spatial infinity. So the distance along a spatial path to infinity is infinite, but a light ray can get there and back in finite time. So massless particles are forever bouncing back and forth to the boundary. They don't disperse. And massive particles actually never get to the boundary, so they're sort of trapped inside. So whatever you have is trapped in a kind of potential well, and the interactions never vanish in the far past or the far future. So you cannot make in anti-de Sitter space any notion of an S matrix. It's not like a conventional infinite volume system. The volume of a time zero slice actually is infinite, but it doesn't behave in the way that we usually associate with having infinite volume. So that has to do with this peculiar form of the metric. I think I'm getting the factors wrong, actually. But the factors are such that on a spatial path, the distance to the boundary is infinite. And as I said before, for a light ray, you can get back and forth in finite time. Now, because you can literally see the boundary, a laser beam shined into empty space would be reflected from the boundary and get back to us before the end of the lecture if the cosmological constant were large enough and negative. Because you can literally see the boundary, you naturally want to include it in doing the physics. So you sort of think of boundary points as being real. But the metric, because the distance in the spatial directions is infinite, the metric doesn't extend naturally over the boundary. To make a metric that extends over the boundary, you need to divide by an infinite factor, which is sort of 1 over r squared squared. And then you can make a metric that does extend over the boundary, but there's no precise natural way to pick exactly what factor you want to divide by. And because of the indeterminacy in what factor you divide by, in order to get a metric that does extend on the boundary, you end up with the fact that the boundary has not a metric, not quite a metric, but only a conformal structure. That means a metric up to conformal rescaling. So the boundary is obviously a manifold of one dimension less. And of course, the symmetries of anti-de Sitter space are automatically symmetries of the boundary. They map boundary points to boundary points. But while the interior has a metric and the symmetries of the interior are ordinary isometries, the symmetries of the boundaries are only conformal motions. They preserve the conformal structure, but not the metric. So you have this basic fact that if you take anti-de Sitter space in n plus 1 dimensions, it has this symmetry group SO2n, which are isometries. But the boundary has only n dimensions. Let's call it m sub n. It has the same group, but this is a group of conformal symmetries. Well, what's the N manifold that has SO2N as a group of conformal symmetries? It's simply Minkowski space. And roughly speaking, the boundary is Minkowski space. It's Minkowski space, to be a little more accurate, but still a little bit rough, with some points at infinity added so that the conformal group acts. Anyway, I made a digression about the details of this conformal infinity, but the point I was making before the digression is that in negative cosmological constant, we have no notion of an S matrix. We can't speak of emission and absorption in the far past or future because the theory never simplifies in going to the past or the future. Instead of emission or absorption in the past or the future, you can consider emission and absorption at points on the boundary. It's especially natural if you're considering massless particles because massless particles emitted at a point on the boundary will propagate into the interior and arrive there at a finite time. For massive particles, this operation is more singular, actually. But for massless particles, the absorption and emission on the boundary is completely natural and is the analog of an S matrix. So instead of sources in the far past and the far future that create and annihilate particles, the closest analog we have in anti-de Sitter space are sources that emit and absorb particles on the boundary. Well, what properties will they have? You see, if you emit at x and absorb at y, and x is close to y, you'll get a singularity. So if we start introducing operators that emit and absorb particles at boundary points, we're going to run into short distance singularities, And of course, the whole structure will be conformally invariant because we've got the anti-de Sitter symmetry group that acts as a group of conformal symmetries on the boundary. So now we'll have operators on boundary points with a conformally invariant structure and with universal short distance singularities whenever x approaches y, no matter what else there is, because the emission at x and absorption at y will be independent on what is far away. So it's very natural that you should get out of this a conformal field theory, and this is the conjecture for which the prototype was in Modestena's paper last fall on, for example, ADS5 times S5 being related to n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory on the boundary, well, as subsequently interpreted on the boundary. And of course, it also has precursors going back to a lot of all of literature from the 80s and even before on singletons. So to recapitulate, when the cosmological constant is zero, the S matrix is the most obvious global observable. When the cosmological constant is negative, you don't get an S matrix, but in a way you get something which is more interesting. You get the correlation functions of a conformal field theory, where you have operators inserted on arbitrary boundary points, creating and absorbing particles that propagate in the interior. Now, technically, the way you study this absorption and emission is that, for example, if you have a scalar field phi, you can impose boundary conditions that phi approaches an arbitrarily specified function, phi zero, on the boundary, where you specify phi zero. And then you can start varying phi zero as you wish, and the variation with respect to phi zero, at a point y behaves like a local operator at the point y. So by specifying, so the value of phi zero is roughly like a coherent state of the field on the boundary, which is a connotation of many quanta. And then varying with respect to the boundary value is the right operation to emit and absorb one quantum on the boundary, at least roughly speaking. So by letting the boundary values vary, you can study the absorption and emission of particles. And there's also a beautiful extension of this described by Modestena and Ray and Yi, where you have strings whose world sheets end on the boundary on Wilson lines. So there you specify the boundary values not of a field, but of a string world sheet. And now you're considering not local operators on the boundary, but boundary operators that depend on strings, corresponding to Wilson lines of gauge theories. And there also are still more exotic variants of this. But the general idea is always that you define your global observables by saying what there is on the boundary of anti-de Sitter space, and you calculate the correlation functions of those global observables by doing the supergravity, or to be more precise, the string theory in the interior with the given boundary conditions. So from a gravitational theory on anti-de Sitter space, or more realistically on anti-de Sitter space times some compact manifold, we get a conformal field theory on the boundary, which is essentially Minkowski space. Now, it's deeper and a little bit less obvious, but it seems that the gravity theory is really equivalent to the conformal field theory, not just that the conformal field theory is something we extract from the gravity. This assertion really uses gravity, not just the fact that we're on anti-de Sitter space. The recipe I gave for extracting conformal field theory correlation functions by considering the behavior at infinity in any relativistic theory on anti-de Sitter space doesn't assume that there's gravity. If you considered any relativistic field theory in anti-de Sitter space, the boundary values would give you, apparently, a conformal field theory. But the claim that you haven't lost anything in restricting to those boundary observables is false for theories without gravity. That it's true for theories with gravity is a deeper statement, which we don't know for sure. I think it's perhaps a much deeper statement. But there is striking evidence for it. For example, from the fact that black hole thermodynamics, which we believe in some sense captures everything and emits nothing for quantum gravity in the field of a black hole is reproduced by the thermodynamics of the conformal field theory. The statement analogous to this one would fail if you considered an anti-de Sitter theory without gravity. You could still define a boundary conformal field theory, but its thermodynamics would be too small. Its entropy wouldn't be big enough at high temperatures. It would miss most of the degrees of freedom. So, for two cases where the cosmological constant lambda is zero or negative, I've described the global observables, namely the S matrix and the conformal field theory. Now, I think in many ways the second is more interesting because it gives a microscopic definition of a gravitational theory. Well, what do I mean when I say that? Well, I'll make a statement about this one, which I think will be reasonable, and then the analog up here will not seem reasonable. So, if we say, as Maldacena proposed, essentially, that string theory on ADS5 times S5 is equivalent to N=4 Super-Yang-Mills theory on the boundary, that seems like a very illuminating statement, because it gives a non-perturbative definition of this theory, which is a difficult quantum gravity theory that is hard to understand conceptually even. It gives a non-perturbative definition of that theory in terms of a conventional Yang-Mills theory. So that seems like an extremely illuminating and incisive statement. But the naive analog when the cosmological constant is zero is extremely frustrating. The naive analog would appear to be string theory in asymptotically flat space is equivalent to its S matrix, which possibly is where the subject began 30 years ago, but nevertheless isn't a very satisfying statement. Well, at this stage, we might want to reflect on the meaning of the claim that in the presence of quantum gravity, the world is holographic, and described by a theory that's associated with the boundary of space-time. Well, at a very crude level, the statement that the observables are global in nature is much older and was the content of my first transparency. It just comes from the fact that local operators could not be generally covariant in a theory with diffeomorphisms. So the statement of philosophy, if it's really supposed to challenge us, must mean not just that the observables are at infinity, which is standard in the presence of gravity, but it must mean that in some sense the degrees of freedom are at infinity, or at least that there is a description in which the degrees of freedom are at infinity. It must mean that there is a way to define the theory in terms of degrees of freedom at infinity. Well, by now we know, I might say, okay, since things have changed a lot in the last few years, it's hard to remember this, but 5 years ago this claim sounded like it was way off at the frontier of what was barely credible. But by now we know that this claim is correct when the cosmological constant is negative. The relation to boundary conformal field theory beautifully describes quantum gravity with negative cosmological constant in terms of a theory with all its degrees of freedom at infinity. So it's been done with negative cosmological constant, which is good, because actually what we're trying to do is hard to formulate. Since the degrees of freedom can't be really localized in the presence of gravity, it's a little bit hard to explain exactly what constitutes success a priori, but a posteriori for negative cosmological constant, this is certainly success. So, as I just said, the correspondence between conformal field theory and anti-de Sitter is a really nice way to make precise that if the cosmological constant is negative, the degrees of freedom are at infinity. It actually does more than that. It incorporates the information bounds, which is an important part of the holographic package, according to Hooft and Susskind. And this depends on a striking aspect of the theory, which is an amazing reversal between the ultraviolet and the infrared. So, the reversal is that what to an observer in the interior is the infrared is actually the ultraviolet to an observer at the boundary. So there are lots of aspects of this. One of them arises when we make the correspondence between the quantum field operators and the variation with respect to the boundary values. In doing that, you find that the dimension of the quantum field operator curly O is related to the asymptotic behavior of phi as you approach the boundary. In general, phi goes to phi zero times perhaps the divergent factor. And the divergent factor, which is at spatial infinity, so it's an infrared effect, turns into an anomalous dimension, or at least a dimension of this operator. So in many ways, you find that infrared in the inside goes into ultraviolet on the boundary. And now if you would put in an infrared divergence in the boundary in the interior, so that there's only a finite volume, then the boundary theory has an ultraviolet cutoff, and we can make sense of how many degrees of freedom it has. And as predicted holographically, the number of degrees of freedom matches with the boundary area in Planck units. So when lambda is zero, we really get the holographic package. Well, what when lambda is less than zero? Now, why can't we do this when lambda is zero? Probably all kinds of reasons, but one of them is certainly that the natural boundary of Minkowski space is not at spatial infinity, but is at past and future null infinity. So, for negative cosmological constant, we've been exploiting this Penrose diagram. But for zero cosmological constant, the Penrose diagram looks completely different and is a kind of diamond with some points that won't help us too much in the past and future and at spatial infinity. But the main part of it is that we've got past and future null infinity. So now, since here we emitted and absorbed particles on the boundary, we could try doing the same here. But since the boundary points are in the infinite past and future, emission and absorption on the boundary appears to be just a way of talking about the S-matrix. In fact, most naturally, the S-matrix of massless particles. So an obvious imitation of this construction appears to just tell us again that all we can think of is the S-matrix. And I think it will be best if, rather than an anticlimax later, I remove the suspense by letting you know that I haven't thought of anything else. So there's a feeling that in going from this picture to this one, we've really lost something. Because here, the boundary observables were a conformal field theory, which gave us a non-perturbative definition of the theory. And here, we don't feel that saying that a theory is equivalent to its S-matrix is satisfactory as a non-perturbative definition. Here we feel that just the boundary observables are losing what we want to capture. So, I think a technical reason something is being lost is the following. Here I've drawn a picture, again, with negative cosmological constant, and here are two boundary points. Well, in the anti-de Sitter case, those are two arbitrary boundary points. You could now ask what they're going to do when the cosmological constant goes to zero. Suppose that we've got a compactification where the cosmological constant is a variable parameter, and let's make it smaller. Well, Minkowski space doesn't have a boundary at spatial infinity, so the whole boundary moves away when lambda becomes smaller. If you try to keep the separation between x and y fixed, what will happen is, in the limit, the whole emission and absorption between them takes place at infinity in Minkowski space, and is of no interest to an observer in the interior. If you want to observe something in the interior, which you describe in terms of those boundary observables, in the limit as the cosmological constant goes to zero, then as far as I can see, you have to take x to the past and y to the future, so that the signal, which can propagate a little bit inside, as lambda goes to zero, that little bit isn't enough, unless you separate x and y. And then, when lambda goes to zero, but x and y get farther and farther apart, so the signal can get farther. In the limit, you're left with something if x goes to the far past and y goes to the far future. But then you lose the beautiful structure of conformal field theory, the short distance singularities and all that. and you're simply left with sources creating particles in the past and annihilating them in the future, giving us the S-matrix. So I think that technically this construction doesn't have a nice limit as lambda goes to zero, because the only way to get a non-trivial limit out of it is to separate the emission and absorption points by an infinite amount, which we could have done also when lambda was negative, but then obviously if lambda is negative, we don't want to do that. We would lose most of the information if we restricted ourselves to that case. So that's the problem with lambda is zero. Now, as David Gross reminded us in the introduction, there is some experimental evidence, at least, that lambda might be positive. So we should say at least a word about that case. So if lambda is positive, there actually is, once again, a kind of S-matrix. And the only obvious global observable is the S-matrix. The Penrose diagram looks something like this, with past and future infinity. The paradigm is that if lambda is negative, you've got spatial infinity. If lambda is zero, you have null infinity, and if lambda is positive, you have past and future infinity. Now, to have an S-matrix, the basic prerequisite is that the interactions turn off in the far past and the far future. And when lambda is positive, they do so because of inflation. Anything is inflated away in the future, except for massless particles that can be redshifted indefinitely. Now, the massless particles, when they get redshifted indefinitely, stop interacting. In fact, they stop changing. So what it means if our massless particle is the graviton is that the metric in the far future can be an arbitrary metric on the spatial section. So you see, de Sitter space is something like this, where d omega squared is the metric for the round sphere. But you could replace d omega squared by anything and get a solution in the far future. So for the massless particles, you have a transition from an arbitrary geometry in the past to an arbitrary geometry in the future. You can specify the geometries in the past and future and calculate a transition amplitude with those geometries specified. What about massive particles? Well, massive particles eventually separate from each other due to the exponential expansion of de Sitter space, unless they form bound states, in which case the bound state should be thought of as one particle, and in turn they separate from whatever they aren't bound to. So unlike the case of lambda equals zero, where the S-matrix involves propagation to and from spatial infinity, as well as infinite past and future and time, here our massive particles are stuck like flies on flypaper in some fixed geometry in the far past and the far future. So our transition is between a fixed geometry in the past and future with stuck massive particles that can be specified arbitrarily in the past and future. So we've got one of those. We could call it an S-matrix if lambda is positive. And we've got the conventional S-matrix if lambda is zero. And we've got conformal field theory if lambda is negative. But of those three, only the last one seems like what we would want to call a microscopic definition of a theory. Well, by the way, if lambda is positive, we shouldn't maybe have surprised that we had trouble understanding holography, because at a more basic level, we didn't know what it meant. For lambda positive, at least the de Sitter solution has closed spatial sections without boundary. And so if the observables were supposed to be in the boundary, we don't quite know what that was supposed to mean. So perhaps we shouldn't be too surprised that we couldn't make sense of holography for positive lambda. And unless the experimental evidence, which I think is still highly preliminary, is right, maybe we don't need to. It's interesting that string theory that we now have stable solutions with positive lambda. I think it's maybe more surprising that for lambda equals zero, it's so hard to understand holography. Going back to the cases that I've been talking about mainly, lambda negative or zero, well, in hindsight, as I've been stressing, the geometry of anti-de Sitter space makes holography seem almost inevitable if lambda is negative. But for lambda is zero, we're going to have a much tougher time, for the reason I told you, that Minkowski space doesn't have a natural boundary at spatial infinity. So what are we going to do? Well, as I've already warned you, I don't have the slightest idea. I noticed that the only thing approaching a candidate, the only proposal for a theory at lambda equals zero that might be holographic, apart from string theory itself, Lycoln string perturbation theory, the only non-perturbative proposal for a holographic theory of lambda equals zero is the matrix model. Well, it's not really known if the matrix model is holographic. I'm not even sure it's been fully formulated what properties it has to have to make the answer yes. But whatever they are, they haven't been demonstrated. Some have been specified, like the growth that the bound state wave function should have, and it's not really known if they do grow appropriately. But if the matrix model is holographic, it certainly achieves this distinguished status in a very different way from what we have at negative lambda. Whatever the matrix model is, it's not a local field theory in some space-time that lives at the boundary of Minkowski space. It's a theory of matrices, and you have to make of it what you wish. Now, of course, the matrix model is known in a non-covariant form, in a sort of light cone gauge, and it might have a more covariant version. And if it does, then finding that would be very important. And well, you'd think that if there was a natural boundary, the covariant version would have somehow been related to some kind of theory on that boundary. And since there isn't a natural boundary, you would think that if there is a covariant version of the matrix model, it would tell us what you're supposed to do instead of conformal field theory on the boundary of anti-de Sitter space. But these things haven't emerged yet. Now, I think that it's going to be hard for a number of reasons to understand holography for zero lambda, and I've told you some of them already. But one of the reasons I think that it's inevitably going to be hard to understand holography for zero lambda is that apparently success would have an explanation of lambda, of why the cosmological constant is zero built in. Now, I got to admit, I am still assuming that after supernovas are studied more fully, we'll be left trying to explain why lambda is zero and not why it's extremely small and positive. I'd settle for small and negative, but the experimentalists aren't going that way. But when I speak of an explanation of why lambda is zero, I'm going to aim for an explanation in a very weak sense, much weaker than what we want, but much stronger than what we have. If someone will discover a stable vacuum in an asymptotically flat world without supersymmetry, I'll call that, at least in a weak sense, an explanation of why the cosmological constant vanishes, or at least an explanation of why it might vanish without supersymmetry. So, holography would entail an explanation of this in the following sense. Well, if you find a conformal field theory in n dimensions, and then interpret it as a holographic description of a gravitational theory in one dimension more, or one non-compact dimension more, this is automatically tied to negative lambda just from the fact that the symmetry group of conformal field theory is the invariance group of anti-de Sitter space and not the invariance group of lambda zero or positive. Well, a holographic theory for lambda equals zero will therefore not involve conformal field theory but something else. Since we don't know what it is, we'll call it X. And we don't know what structure group X is, but whatever it is, just as conformal field theory corresponds to a stable world with negative cosmological constant, an example of structure X will correspond to a stable vacuum with lambda equals zero. Well, you might put a question mark next to the word stable. In assuming that structure X is related to a stable vacuum, I'm assuming that regardless of what happens in physics in the long run, just for this question of doing holography at lambda equals zero, we don't need to do cosmology. Maybe I'm wrong, and we have to get not zero lambda on the nose, but a universe that evolves to zero lambda. But I'm assuming that we can get zero lambda on the nose. So I'm assuming that that structure X is some weird thing that automatically leads to a gravity theory that's asymptotically flat, just as conformal field theory automatically leads to a gravity theory with negative cosmological constant. So, I don't know anything much to say about it, except that a too naive version of the structure we want, I think it's too naive, and I'll say why in a second. If you take null infinity in Minkowski space, well, it's a manifold of one dimension less. It's got a peculiar type of conformal structure with a signature with one zero and a lot of pluses. It's got a kind of null conformal structure. And it's got an infinite dimensional symmetry group, the BMS group of general relativists. So you could ask whether, just as when lambda is negative, we do field theory on the boundary using its differential geometry, which is conformal geometry, maybe we should do field theory on the boundary using this. I doubt it, I think for three reasons. I hope I can remember all three. No, I didn't write them down. One is that there are two components, which looks extremely ugly. It looks like, well, whatever we do, doing it on two pieces looks like we'll end up talking about the S matrix, one in the past and one in the future. The only way around that I can remotely imagine is complexifying this, where the two components get connected. Secondly, well, the differential geometry of this boundary seems awfully peculiar. There might be a nice theory there, but it's a little bit hard to imagine it. And whatever we can make of the matrix model as a clue, the matrix model as we know it now isn't a field theory anywhere. It doesn't look like it's a field theory on this peculiar null infinity, though I can't guarantee it isn't after being made covariant somehow. Okay, I tried to minimize the anticlimax with suitable warnings earlier, and I'll stop here.
Any questions from the audience? Yes.
Maybe a question of representation theory when you move to what X would be. In the case of AGM,
yes.
You can't construct all the politics representation instead of some waiting on single count or double count.
Yes.
We have to ask the same question, is it possible for the Lorentz of one variable to do such thing?
Okay, so the question is, for the structure X, maybe the representation theory will give a clue.
Hasn't given a clue to me. I certainly am not going to say it shouldn't. All I can do is draw the picture again, I'm afraid. But you see, I'll make maybe one comment, joking aside. So the singleton representations you're mentioning, you've got this symmetry group, SO2N. And it's a symmetry of two kinds of things, anti-de Sitter in the interior, and also conformal field theory on the boundary. So among its representations are representations that come from free fields on the boundary. So the singleton representations are actually a way of telling us that we could do free fields on the boundary, and then the excitement, let's say, in the last year, well, people realized, I think, 10 or 20 years ago, that you could do also non-free conformal field theories on the boundary, and that they would have something, they would be some kind of generalized singletons. But the change in point of view in the last year is that instead of enriching or supplementing a bulk theory by a free or non-free theory on the boundary, now we apparently have a theory in the interior that's equivalent to a non-free conformal field theory on the boundary. So if I pursue the line of thought of your question, we have the representations which to me go with the field theories on the boundary, free ones and, if you're more sophisticated, non-free ones. So the only thing that suggests to me is to try to do field theory on this boundary with its very funny differential geometry, a conformal metric of that signature, and a funny symmetry group. So there might be field theories on that boundary. I don't think it's really a question that's been asked in the past, but on the other hand, I can't see any kind of answer to it either. Tom? There won't be a stress tensor. Sorry, a non-gravitational theory in the bulk Okay. Depends on what your axioms are. It'll give the Whiteman axioms of conformal field theory, which talk about global conformal invariants. But I don't think it has a stress tensor.
But I don't think it'll satisfy
unitarity. Well, that's not one of the Whiteman axioms. You're right. Perhaps it should be. So it'll have some of the characteristics. It'll actually obey textbook definitions, many textbook definitions of a quantum field theory. Many textbook definitions of a quantum field theory say that you've got a Hilbert space. Hilbert space means unitary. And that you've got a representation of the symmetry group here, the conformal group, a unitary representation. And you've got local operators that commute inside the light cone and have some specified type of singularities they're allowed to have. So it'll do all that. So it'll obey Whiteman axioms or Bjorkane and Gell definitions. It'll obey many definitions of a quantum field theory, but it will not have a local stress tensor. And it has a closed operator expansion, product expansion. When you ask about that, I'm not sure precisely what property you think might fail. There will be a perfectly good operator product expansion. There probably are funny things if you consider a general four manifold instead of Minkowski space on the boundary. And there isn't a stress tensor. And an analog, I might say, is that you could take a plane in R3. If you've got a quantum field theory in R3, you could take a plane in R3 and consider only the local operators on that plane. That'll give a subsystem that'll obey the definitions in many books of what a quantum field theory is. The main thing it doesn't have is a stress tensor. And it's similar to this other thing you asked about. Yes?
I have a small confusion about how one might connect this idea of holography to what you see in black holes. For normal systems, the entropy of the system depends on the degrees of freedom, but also how much energy you put into excite it.
Right.
So should we be asking how many degrees of freedom there are in a given volume? Or should we be asking, if I have a given energy, what's the minimum volume I need to hold that many degrees of freedom? Maybe as I put more energy, I need to gain more and more volume.
Well, do you want to do this in anti de Sitter? Because in anti de Sitter, I think all reasonable definitions will give the same answer. In anti de Sitter, if you pump in a lot of energy, because of a sort of redshifting factor, your particles will stay away from the boundary. They're effectively in a potential well. And all the criteria you asked for will have the same answer. So if you pump in a given amount of energy, assuming that that energy is big enough, if it's Planckian, you'll get a more complicated answer that depends on the details. But if the energy you pump in is big enough, the most likely, what it will usually do is to form a black hole that fills up all the energy and takes up the appropriate space. So the answers to all your questions will coincide in anti de Sitter space. I don't know if that answered your question, though.
We only have time for one more question.
If one would embed the ADS example as a near horizon, sort of coming back to this question, then there's still sort of a Minkowski region outside of the ADS region. To say a few words how about the S matrix and the conformal field theory might join into one picture in that case.
I'm not sure I can say anything enlightening that wouldn't be a platitude. Okay. Suitable S matrix elements at low energies and suitable limits go over into some correlation functions of the conformal field theory. That's roughly how the conformal field theory was discovered.
But would in that case one need to distinguish, say, incoming and outgoing operators in the conformal field theory?
I think what you want to do is to you want to create a situation where at the throat, where the two regions are joined, you have arbitrary initial data. And to achieve that, you need a combination of incoming and outgoing particles in Minkowski space. So some limits of some S matrix elements would enable you to determine the conformal field theory. I don't have anything more to say about it than that, I'm afraid.
Okay, well, let's thank the speaker again.